I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is feminist icon, journalist, and activist Gloria Steinem. She's joined in conversation by actress and entrepreneur Jada Pinkett Smith. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Gloria Steinem and Jada Pinkett Smith.
Feminist icon Gloria Steinem has been at the forefront of the women's rights movement for decades, and she's still trying to break down the barriers that have blocked full equality for women. She co-founded Ms. Magazine at a time when most magazines for women were limited to advice about saving marriages, raising babies, or using the right cosmetics. Ms. helped shape contemporary feminism and became a landmark institution in both women's rights and American journalism. The Ms. Foundation for Women is a national multiracial, multi-issue fund that supports grassroots projects to empower women and girls. Its Take Our Daughters to Work Day, a national day devoted to girls, has become an institution here and in other countries. Gloria Steinem has helped to nurture the talent of generations of feminists through her social activism, including founding and co-founding a number of influential national organizations focusing on human rights and pro-choice activism. These include the Women's Action Alliance, the National Women's Political Caucus, the Pro-Choice Political Action Committee, Voters for Choice, Choice USA, and the Women's Media Center. Her films include a documentary on child abuse for HBO and a feature film about the death penalty for Lifetime. She's the author of the bestsellers Revolution from Within, a book on self-esteem, Outrageous Acts and Everyday Rebellions, Moving Beyond Words, and Marilyn, Norma Jean, on the life of Marilyn Monroe. Her latest book, My Life on the Road, 20 Years in the Making, reflects on a lifetime of travel as a singular mode of human connection, retracing the many roads she's taken along her journey and what they've taught her about the vital art of public listening. Appearing in conversation with Gloria Steinem is Jada Pinkett Smith, an actress, producer, director, best-selling children's author, singer-songwriter, businesswoman, and philanthropist. Jada Pinkett Smith contributes much of her free time to humanitarian efforts, helping to raise awareness on issues such as human trafficking. She also serves on the advisory board of Gucci's empowerment initiative, Chime for Change, which campaigns for improved education, health, and justice for women and girls worldwide. Along with her husband, Will Smith, she founded the Smith Family Foundation, dedicated to urban inner-city youth and family support. Please join me in welcoming Gloria Steinem and Jada Pinkett Smith to the JCCSF. Thank you.
Thank you for being here with us tonight to celebrate this wonderful woman that we're all so blessed to have the opportunity to spend time with this evening.
And to celebrate this wonderful woman. also, yeah.
Gloria, I have to tell you, I have always loved you. But after reading this book, you know, in my mind, I consider you to be such a beautiful representation of what I feel as though every feminist should look like. Every feminist should think like. And I'll tell you why. After reading this book, I realized how much love you have for all women, no matter their ethnicity, no matter their economic status, no matter what, right? So that for me is very rare. And I really want to know Because, you know, I consider myself a lover of all women as well. But when I read your book, you don't just talk it. You actually have submerged yourself in groups like the Native American nations in order to help, you know, bring those disappeared voices to the forefront. I want to know, what aspect of your life made that so important to lend, to flow power and lend your skill to women across the board?
Well, you know, listening to you say that, I kind of, first of all, it's so pleasurable, I don't know what to do with myself. And my first thought is the reward, you know, listening to people's stories never fails to widen you and broaden you and take you places you've never been. Mm-hmm. But you're asking a deeper question.
Yes.
And I think really it was because my mother, or at least partly because my mother, was a very talented, thoughtful, loving, extraordinary woman who had been one of the first newspaper journalists at a time when it must have been tough because in the beginning she had to write under a man's name in order to get published at all.
Right.
And she became an editor. She came from a working class family. Life wasn't easy. Nothing was easy. And all of that had happened before I was born.
Right.
So I didn't really understand it or know about it until much later, because by the time I saw her, she was kind of broken-spirited. You know, she had had to give up, not because my father was not a good person, he was, but just the way the world ran, she could not do it all.
Right.
And had a nervous breakdown and been hospitalized and couldn't always take care of herself and so on. So I think the combination of seeing what could have been,
right,
and what was, perhaps made me sensitive to it in other women.
Got it.
You know, I think maybe a lot of us here might be living the lives our mothers couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, living out the unlived life of our mother. And I suppose in some ways I'm doing that. And I hope that period comes to an end, you know, because women should be able to lead their own lives, not their daughters.
Right.
But I notice, for instance, that even now when I see an old woman in the street who looks like she can't quite manage the world, I feel more touched by her than I do by children, which is saying a lot, because we're all touched by children, right? So maybe it's that. Maybe I just got so struck by the loss, the waste of human talent, that it made it easier for me to see in other people. But all I can say is it is not self-sacrificial. It is a gift. It is a gift, you know, to it. I do what I love.
No, that's right. What I could feel when I was reading your book, and that's what made it so impactful. I mean, so much so, I had to even look at my own activism and see how limited it is. Because
this part I don't believe at all. Because I know this woman. This is not right.
Well, you know,
what do you mean limited?
Well, limited in the fact that, you know, when I was looking at the outreach that you had in so many different communities, I realized that, like, Native American women, I was like, my goodness, like, here I am. And even with, you know, my activism in human trafficking, I never even thought about, you know, that kind of outreach to Native American women. And it was through your book that I was like, I have got to make that a point, you know.
But that's because people don't tell us. You
no,
know,
it's
not
true.
It's not a fault that our educational system starts with Columbus.
Right. You know,
and forget who was not a nice guy at all.
Right.
And a terrible navigator. but he was not a nice guy. I mean, he took female slaves for his ship's crew and couldn't understand why they fought back. He
right.
was shocked.
Right. Right.
And we don't learn about the huge, great subtle, accomplished civilizations that were here long, 100,000 years before,
right,
and continuous and now coming back, I'm happy to say. Nobody tells us that.
Right. I have to tell you that I really connected to your mother's despair. And I think because even in my own life, you know, I had those moments, you know, as a young woman who had gotten pregnant and then I got married, all of it happened so fast, right? And my life changed really quickly. And, you know, you're trying to figure out, you know, I once had this freedom and now I kind of don't. You're trying to find this balance between home and freedom, right? And I tell you what, from reading your book, because I get this question a lot from other women who are going through that particular point in their life that thank goodness I found a way to come out of, but I realized that every woman has to be a pioneer in finding her balance between, and her understanding between home and freedom, that stability and freedom. I want to thank you for that piece of just that understanding that we all have to be a pioneer in our own right in defining for us what that means.
No, it's true. We all, I mean, since I had cared for my mother, maybe that's part of the reason that, you know, in some sense I'd already had a child. I didn't want to have children.
Right.
But, and there are many women now who are not punished for not having children. But most women, you know, have to go through this incredible, painful balancing act. But I just want to say that women should not have to.
Right.
Because men need to be equal and loving and nurturing parents as well. And
right,
that, it's a gift to men. It's not a punishment. I mean, men end up not being close to their own children. I noticed that men who marry for a second time and realize that they didn't know the children of their first marriage are way more devoted to the children of, you know, because they began to realize what they missed.
Right.
There's a wonderful book by Dorothy Dinnerstein called The Mermaid and the Minotaur.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read that book, you will be convinced that men raising children or being raised to raise children is the key to world peace.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because it's how, I mean, women tend to develop our whole human selves, all of our human qualities, by being in the world outside the home.
Right.
Men develop their whole human selves and all their qualities, including those qualities wrongly called feminine, because they're just what you need to raise a child. Patience, attention to detail, empathy, kindness, all of those things. And so for men to be whole people and not get addicted to the masculine role of control,
right,
and dominance, mm-hmm, which men did not invent and are not to blame for but got born into,
mm-hmm,
for men to get rid of that, they need to be raised to raise children,
right,
so to speak.
Right.
So I don't want women to have to be pioneers. I want children to know that men are loving and nurturing. Actually, I lucked out in that way because my father looked after me until I was 10 or so, at least as much as my mother.
Right.
And though he was 100% irresponsible in many ways, you know, taking me to adult movies, feeding me nothing but ice cream, you know. It didn't matter because he loved me. He loved my company. I was his like co-conspirator. I was in heaven, you
right,
know. And he was kind and gentle and patient. So, and here's another benefit of that. It means that the men in the rest of your life are kind and gentle and pregnant, but you know they exist.
Well, that's interesting because I was just looking at this, what you said about your father in the book, which I loved. You said, all I knew is that my father enjoyed my company, asked my opinion, treated me better than he treated himself. What more could any child want? And I was going to ask you, like, how did this affect, like, you know, the relationships with the, you
it's
know,
great,
the men in your life?
I owe to my father every nice lover I've ever had in my life.
That's
true.
Awesome.
I mean, if you see women who have had distant or cold or hostile or even violent fathers, as women have had, you see women who probably in their adult lives seek out cold, distant, violent men in order to redo that relationship and make them love them, if you know what I mean, or just because they don't know there's another kind of man. So it's super, super important that we see love and patience and, you know, everything we need as children in both men and women. It doesn't matter whether it's biological parents. If there are two women who have a child or two men who have a child, there's still other people in their lives. And also that it comes in different forms and shades and colors. It's just, we're so much the result of our childhood.
Right.
And what's possible. We can get over it if we had a limited childhood, but it takes a while. So why not get a head start?
Yeah, I also found it pretty interesting in the chapter Talking Circles that you first started your speaking engagements with African American women. And I thought that was really interesting. Talk to me a little bit about why you did that.
Well, in the first place, I did it. I mean, I think things work best when they're real.
Right.
Okay. So I was really afraid of public speaking. And I had devoted much of my life to never speaking in public. I was a writer, and I had written a little bit about the then new excitement of the women's movement because I could write for New York Magazine, which I helped to start, but nobody of my other editors was interested at all, except one who said, yeah, you can write an article about how women are equal, but right next to it I'll have to print one saying women are not equal in order to be objective. So at the same time, because of this one article I had done for New York Magazine, I was getting invitations to speak, which terrified me, but I was so excited by the explosion of consciousness that was happening that I wanted to be able to do it. So I asked my friend, Dorothy Pittman Hughes, who had become my friend because I wrote about her child care center, and we had actually converted a radical Italian guy who was working in her child care center who said that his fiancée wouldn't marry him because he didn't want her to work.
Right.
So Dorothy and I, who didn't know each other at all, looked at each other and went to work on him, connecting his radicalism about everything else to women. It worked. They got married. They're still married. You know.
Wow.
So Dorothy and I thought, well, if we did that together on instinct, maybe we can speak together. And people were telling me if I went to Dubuque as an unmarried New York woman, I would be, you know, slaughtered.
Right.
If I tried to talk. So I thought, well, Dorothy has children. She's an expert in child rearing. And she's fearless.
Right.
So it had substance. It wasn't artificial ever. And I'm not sure that either one of us fully realized the impact at the time of the fact of that we were an African-American woman, a European-American woman.
Right.
But we soon realized how great and important that was because we got audiences that neither one of us could ever have got alone.
Right.
And it made the point that, I mean, you know, the idea that race and sex are treated separately drives me up the wall. I can't, you know, but it immediately said, we're talking about all women.
Right.
And it allowed us also to point out that to perpetuate racism, you have to control women's bodies. So racism and sexism are intertwined, and you actually can't fight one without also fighting the other.
That is a very... That's very interesting. We'll come back to that. We'll come back to that.
You're listening to feminist icon, journalist, and activist Gloria Steinem, whose memoir is My Life on the Road. She's joined in conversation by actress and entrepreneur Jada Pinkett Smith on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
There was another female in this book that I just thought was amazing. I call her the gangster Jewish feminist, Bella Abzug. Yeah.
Yeah.
She was just
no,
gangster.
I miss her every day, every day. Yeah.
One thing that she said that I just loved that you have in the book, she didn't want to replace a white male middle-class elite with a white female middle-class elite. And I was so impressed with that idea. So then, what do we replace it with? What is it?
Well, you know, she had such a deep, profound sense of injustice. And also, she had been one of those lawyers who went south to defend young black men
that
who
have been...
would otherwise had no defense whatsoever.
Right.
And she was sleeping in bus stations because the white folks wouldn't give her a place to stay, and she endangered black families if she stayed with them. I mean,
yes.
You know, she had a Jewish sense of justice, right?
Yes.
I mean, totally. And she was outrageous and funny and difficult and yelled at you and, you know, she loved conflict. I hate conflict. So I was trying to learn from Bella how to live with conflict. And she was wonderfully funny and outrageous. I'll just tell you one story. You'll see what I mean. One of the things that happened while I was at Ms. Magazine was that Al Goldstein, who was a purveyor of pornography,
right,
and, you know, a very sleazy, terrible guy, he hated us at Ms. Magazine, and so he was always putting our number out there as sex services, and, you know, so people would call, and our poor receptionist would end up in tears, and, you know, all of this. And he, in his so-called magazine or kind of tabloid, he had a centerfold, you know, it was like a big tabloid, a centerfold of a drawing that was clearly me, a nude drawing with the hair and glasses and so on. And on top it said, "Pin the on the feminist." So this was, you know, on newsstands all over New York. I got a lawyer to send him a lawyer's letter about it, and he sent back a 5-pound box of candy with a note that said, "Eat it."
Oof.
Okay, so I was feeling kind of depressed by this.
Right.
And Bella and I were doing a benefit together or something. And Bella said to me, "What's wrong?" So I explained to her this, you know, what had happened, and here was this drawing of me, this nude drawing, you know, with hair and glasses, you know, in full labial detail with my hair and glasses and everything like that. And she wasn't impressed at all. And so I explained to her again, you know, it was clearly me with a, you know, and she said, "And my labia," she said. And she made me laugh so hard that I suddenly felt much better about it.
I have to tell you, one of the events in the book that you spoke about, I have to be honest, I was so upset that I didn't know about it, and that is the National Women's Conference in Houston in 1977. Mm-hmm. Can you just talk to the audience a little bit about this particular event? Because I don't know how many of you knew about it, but I wish that it was such an impactful idea. Mm-hmm. And then I want to talk to you about what was the outcome of that particular conference. But yeah, could you just talk to us a little bit?
Yeah, this it's the biggest, most important event nobody knows about.
Yes, truly.
The United Nations, as you may remember, had declared the Year of the Woman, and there was a first big conference in Mexico City. So each country was supposed to be represented by the needs of their the female half of the population. And so President Ford had appointed a delegation which was headed by a guy from the State Department.
Right.
So so Bella said, wait a minute, you know, if we're going to be represented to other countries about what American women want, we have to know what American women want.
Right.
And so she and Shirley Chisholm and Patsy Mink...
Yes.
...actually, over a long period of time, persuaded Congress to allocate money to a women's conference in every state and territory in the nation, where delegates were elected and issues were selected for a national conference in Houston. It took 2 years, you know, to do all the state and territorial conferences. And also the delegations had to be representative by ethnicity, race, economics.
Right.
It may have been the only time this country has ever produced, you know... I mean, there were 20,000 women in Albany alone for a conference.
Yes.
So, you know, it was huge. It went on and on. We were all commissioners who were helping to organize this. And so there were 2,000 delegates in Houston voting on all of these issues, and it for 3 days, or more than 3 days. And it was a constitutional convention for the female half of the country that had not been present at the first constitutional convention. It was enormous. It
Yes.
was amazing. It was transforming. Now, at the very same time, Phyllis Schlafly and Bob Dornan, I bet people here remember Robert Dornan, okay, had put on a counterconference of the ultra-right wing calling us God knows what.
Yeah.
So even though we had former first ladies, you know, in our ceremony, and Bella had got every possible patriotic symbol she could think of, Girl Scouts and people running from Seneca Falls with torches, and, you know, nonetheless, the counterconference, which represented no one in terms of election, got the same amount of coverage that we did. And neither one got that much coverage because, it, you know, something happened somewhere else in some other country. I don't know. You know, it just, even though there are a couple of one government and one private book about it, it just didn't get the attention it needed. And it, you know, it brought a very diverse, big national movement together around
Yes.
shared issues.
Yes. And I thought that was amazing. And I was like, wow, I mean, I don't even... Do you think it would be possible to even pull something off like that today?
Well, yeah, we could do it again. I don't know that we could get Congress to fund it again.
Right.
What do you think? I don't think that. But we could do it again. But I think we don't need to do it again. We are. You can see in the public opinion polls that there is a majority support now for all of these issues among women and men.
Right.
But in terms of proceeding with those issues in a practical way, with legislation and actual services and so on, even though there's majority support for all of them, there is huge opposition because now we have a backlash, precisely because we've won the majority consciousness in all the great social justice movements. There is a backlash from those folks who got born into a hierarchy they are now attached to.
Right.
And they are in total panic because in about 20 minutes the country is not going to be a majority white or European-American country anymore. So the same groups are against immigration, against contraception, sex education, abortion, because as they will cheerfully tell you, the white race is committing suicide. I mean, you know, we are in a time of change and backlash.
Right. Do you think that in the movement today, there's the same camaraderie that I feel as though, and when reading this book, mm-hmm. that there was, you know, during, you know, that particular era?
Yeah, no, I think there's more actually.
You do?
There's more. I know that I mean, we have a problem with the imagery. You know, when Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were both running for the presidency, and the press was saying to me and others, which is more important, sex or race? You know, is that, I mean, that's...
Yes.
Hello? You know, I mean, right. Most women in the world... Well, I don't know. So we're still... I fear we're still viewed in silos. You know, the women's movement, the civil rights movement, the gay, lesbian, transgender movement, the environmental movement. But actually... they are all connected. One can't succeed without the success of the other. It's just not possible.
Right.
And if that seems far-fetched about the environmental movement, consider that the single biggest element in global warming long-term is the sheer load of humanity on this spaceship Earth, which comes from forcing women to have children they don't want and frequently can't even survive having.
Right.
Child marriage, all the, you know, it. So it is connected. I mean, the Pope doesn't seem to know it's connected. But it's connected. Right.
I also really enjoyed when you talked about your experiences in cabs. I tend to love going to New York City and jumping in a cab by myself, even though my group doesn't particularly care when I do that, but I love talking to cab drivers,
right.
And I thought that was
see,
so...
you're addicted, too.
Yeah, I am. I was like, see, I'm not crazy. Mm-hmm. Gloria does the same thing. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was so interesting when you told the story, first of all, let me say this also. I did not expect to cry as much as I did while reading your book.
Mm.
I mean, it seemed like every single chapter you had some of the most heartfelt stories. Mm. And when I read this particular story, you happened to be with an African-American gentleman. You guys were just about to get into a cab, and then some young kids drove by and called him the N-word.
Mm-hmm.
And you got in the cab, and the cab driver had overheard this happen. Mm-hmm. And he, I think he was Italian, and he had been married to a Korean woman.
I don't know if he'd overheard, but we were, you know, all of our shockwaves were going up because it was dusk. It felt a little violent when they yelled at him and so on. And, you know, a white woman and a black man together, I don't know. I mean, it was New York. We shouldn't have felt that much in danger, but because of these guys yelling at us, we did. And so when we weren't talking about it, we were feeling it. You know?
Yeah.
And the cab driver looked like, you know, he had on a shirt and an undershirt, and he was a kind of heavyset Italian guy. You know, by stereotype, we feared that he was going to regard us badly, too.
Right.
You know, I could feel it in each other. And actually, it turned out to be the complete opposite.
Yeah, because he said he wanted to give you the ride for free, that it happened to be his anniversary, and then he took a picture of his wife out, who was Korean.
Mm.
And He said
that he just wanted to give us a free ride because it was his anniversary and because we reminded him of him and his wife, who also were not supposed to get married and not supposed to be together. And would we mind if it, you know, was
great.
I was
really touched by that because, you know, it is something about cab drivers for me, for some reason, who give me an opportunity to be submerged into the real world and to realize how much hope there's still left. And I just, for some reason, that particular story was just so, it just really touched me. Also, the story about the truck driver, the guy who took you around to all the truck stops.
Right.
Which I thought was fascinating also because during my touring, I got an opportunity to stop at a lot of truck stops as well and learned a lot about this country that I did not know.
Yeah, no, there is a world out there at night.
Yes.
That probably some of you know, but I certainly didn't know. And I had been speaking on a campus in Boston and needed to get back to New York in order to get a plane early the next morning. So they had rented me a car and given me stolen pillows from the dorms so I could sleep and so, right. Anyway, and the guy who was driving this car, a car service he owned, turned out to be a former truck driver, cross-country truck driver, who had just switched jobs because he never saw his kids, and he, you know. So he started to tell me about his work as a truck driver, and I said, so what do you miss most about it? Thinking it would be the adventure, you know, what's the movie, They Drive by Night? Did you ever, you know, this very dangerous kind of... And he said to me, I miss the community.
Yeah.
And I said, the community? You're driving by yourself? You know, he said, no. You know, do you, so he started to stop at every truck stop. Eventually, we stopped at every truck stop between Boston and New York. And I discovered there is a nighttime world there. You know, mm-hmm. you walk in these, you know, what's dark on the outside, and there's music and lights, and people are sitting there ordering apple pie and motor oil at the same time, and so, and listening to. And there is a world of songs that are trucker songs.
Right.
Did you know that? I mean, it, you know, I. 12 Wheels and a Dozen Roses or something. And
right.
I don't know. I put the titles in there. They're, truck drivers also create a lot of music anyway, the demand for music, because they're listening all night.
Right.
But they have their own world of songs besides.
Yeah. In just all your travel, I mean, one of the things that I got from the book, from, you know, when you were traveling as a child with your father, and just your idea of travel and just traveling throughout this country and just realizing how important it is for us as Americans to travel in the United States of America.
Yes, I think every political office should require that candidates travel in this country for a couple of years and get
Absolutely.
To know. I mean, they keep talking about on television the American people as if we were one lump. Excuse me, we are incredibly diverse and interesting, and I don't think we believe it, because when I say I'm going to Australia or I'm going to Zambia, everybody says, oh, that's wonderful. And then when I say I'm going to Detroit and I'm going to, you know, to even San Francisco,
right.
you know, people say, oh, it must be so tiring to travel all the time.
Yes.
I don't think we have faith in our own country and how interesting it is.
I agree with you. I mean, I have to be honest. I mean, it took me to go, you know, on a music tour through Middle America and spend a lot of time in truck stops and Walmart. And, you know, have the opportunity to talk to a lot of different Americans. Mm-hmm. Even, you know, I'd meet a few fellas that had, you know, the certain Confederate flags and what have you, and just even having the opportunity to hear people's perspective, even if I didn't agree, to get understanding. And, you know, as I read this book again, I was like, as I read your book, I was like, I really need to get back on the road again to just, because it also helps you understand.
We can do this. We can go on the road together.
Yes. But you're so right, Gloria. It's so deeply important, you know, and I think you're absolutely correct as far as, you know, for politicians.
Yeah, they're just, the road is a state of mind as much as it is a state of geography. Because you can travel and stay in your shell.
Yeah.
And you might as well stay at home.
Right.
And also, you can leave your door in the morning and be open and discover all kinds of things. It is about kind of living in the present and being open to people you just come upon. And with that in state of mind, I mean, it perpetuates itself when I'm at home. So the guy who is the garbage man on my block is my best political advisor. He turns out to be the head of some whole precinct in Queens, and so, you know, he knows everything about political life. There's a messenger it's a long story. I won't go through everybody, but it's a state of mind, just an openness and a kind of going with it, like birds hover and wait for a breeze. You know, hover and wait for a person, a story. You know, if you're staying in a hotel, talk to the people you pass.
Yep.
I don't. I can't describe it exactly, but I think you know what I mean, right? It's just a state of openness.
I think that's right. I think that's what I was trying to connect to, that idea that it does create a state of openness. And I think that even people who are connected to activism, it is very important that we travel and that we stay connected in a way that keeps that openness, because that line of communication, we're constantly being open to new ideas and constantly being open to experiences that aren't our own, you know? And I think that's something that needs to be done continuously. You know, you can have one part of your life and it's like, oh, I did that in my teens. No, you got to do it again. You got to keep it going. So, yeah, I agree
with
you.
It's just interesting to start conversations with people or to listen or to, you know, those moments when you're in an elevator that are like wasted moments and you kind of know that you're all thinking the same thing. And if one of you says it, you can say, why not?
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features feminist icon, journalist, and activist Gloria Steinem, whose memoir is My Life on the Road. She's joined in conversation by actress and entrepreneur Jada Pinkett Smith. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
There's a line in your book that really, it hit me hard. And it's from One Big Campus. I'm talking about education and college campuses. And you said, no wonder studies show that women's self-esteem may go down as years of education go up. We have been studying our own absence.
Right.
Ooh.
Right.
That hit me so hard because it couldn't be more true.
Right. No, it's true. You know, actually, that came, my understanding of that came from something called the valedictorian study, which was a 15-year study of high school valedictorians, a whole racially, ethnically representative group of high school valedictorians, over 15 years. So, and the males kept their intellectual self-esteem level pretty much the same. They were all smart kids when they graduated from high school.
Right.
And the females, their intellectual self-esteem went down with every additional year of college education. I imagine it also went down more for the young women of color than for the white women. They didn't. The group was representative, so it was a universal fact. It was probably relative inside that.
Yeah, it's funny because that's one of the reasons why I decided not for the fundamental years of my daughter's education to have her in conventional school. Because, you know, when I was in school, of course, I didn't connect to what was happening in the way that you made it so clear for me in this statement. But, you know, there was this lack of self while I was in school that I just did not, I refused to have my daughter experience that. And so how do you think we could fix that in conventional education? What do you think we need to do?
Well, think of what we could do. You know, we could start history, the history of people when people started.
Right.
What a concept. You
know? Right, right.
We, you know, as we were saying about Columbus, I mean, we don't start our history of this land we are on when people started here. And why not? Well, because we conducted, loosely speaking, we, not us, but anyway, the biggest genocide still in history. 90% of everybody who lived here was killed either by warfare or by disease.
Right.
So we don't start there. And we don't, I mean, the great social justice movements obviously have changed the curriculum. So there is now African American studies, Asian American studies, Native American studies, women's studies, But those, they're pretty much electives. You don't have to take them.
Right.
So I'm glad they're there. They could have saved me 20 years.
Right.
But it's not a regular part of education. And on the contrary, some of the school boards in conservative states, like Texas orders more textbooks than any other state. And so they influence the textbook industry. And they are busily trying to cut out the civil rights movement and the women's movement and everything else from, you know, they're politicizing history in the opposite way.
Right.
So, you know, the Ms. Foundation has funded some great adventures, small adventures in trying to fix this. There was a woman in Alabama, I think, who started something called Saturday University for high school kids. And they loved that it was called university, you know.
Right.
And her point was just to teach them the history of humankind, including them. It was a mostly African-American school.
Right.
You know, so I think it was the first time those kids understood that Africa is bigger, is not one country.
Right.
It's many countries and is bigger than, you know, the U.S., China, Latin America, and Europe combined. Hello? You know, how come we don't? That's another thing. We don't learn proportionately. We learn way more about Europe, which is like a postage stamp in the world, than about Africa, Asia, Latin America. You know, it just makes no sense.
Right.
It's political. It does make sense, but it's political. Right?
I was really, I didn't know this. You said in your book, and when the political is personal in that chapter, my proudest moment was writing a televised speech for Shirley Chisholm in her 1972 run for the U.S. presidency. Why was this your proudest moment?
Well, I think for me, writing and activism were somewhat opposed because I loved activism, but it took away the time to write, and
right.
So it was one of the first times I realized that being a writer could be politically useful, because she had been, as in the words of Flo Kennedy, whited out of the of the political debates, and she had gone to the FCC and, you know, gotten compensatory time.
Right.
It happened very quickly. So we needed a speech overnight. I had run as her delegate, and it's a long story, but anyway. So I had to write this speech. And so just to see, and of course I was using her words, you know, it wasn't as if I had, you know, but I had put together this speech. And just to sit there and see somebody of the importance of Shirley Chisholm and the history-making of Shirley Chisholm, who by herself took the white male-only sign off the White House door,
right,
by herself, to see her saying something that I had written, I was just totally knocked out by it.
Right. Yeah, I was because that was something that I didn't know. There's so much about you that, you know, you have done so much. And, I, you know, just to have the opportunity.
I've figured out.
What?
I was just saying this. She was born the year Ms. Magazine was published, okay? So I just want to say I've had more time.
Right. What would be some of your pointers, or who do you look in today's culture, as being in the forefront of the women's movement?
Well, I think we're in the forefront wherever we are. I don't know if there's, you
one,
know,
yeah.
You know, it's because everything we do counts. I really think women in elected positions are very important because they are way more likely to represent the majority interests. If you're in the corporate world and you've been hired, you know, by one person or 12 people, it's a little bit less probable that you're going to represent the majority issues and interests. And sometimes those women have been picked not to represent women.
Yes.
Right. So I think women in elected office or women who are part of social justice movements, and actually social justice movements are the best source, I think, of political candidates, because if you've once been in that kind of movement, you understand that, as Bella Abzug understood, you don't have to hold your finger to the wind, you can become the wind.
Mm.
You know, it's not just about looking at public opinion polls. When you see something that's unjust or needs fixing, you can create a constituency for it.
So I want to just give you an opportunity to tell us, what is your favorite aspect of this particular lovely book of yours?
What is my favorite aspect? Mm. Well, I think it is that maybe it will inspire or encourage other people to go out on the road. I mean, I do think that political candidates ought to go out for Tuesday.
Absolutely.
But I think maybe in this case, especially women, because the road has been a masculine place.
Mm.
Travel has been a masculine place.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about the hero's journeys that we read in school, or about the on the road, you know, the idea is really that it's a masculine adventure, and that it would be dangerous for women. And that is especially embedded in very, very conservative cultures in the Middle East, especially, mm-hmm. where women are not allowed to leave home even, you know, without their husbands or even brothers' permission. And even if women do manage to leave home and adventure, like Isaac Dinesen did, or like Thelma and Louise did, or somewhere, right? They come to a bad end, you know. But I figured out while I was writing this that actually, in real terms that we can now measure by DNA and so on, it is women who have been the travelers and men who have been the stay-at-homes, because women have traveled to marry. I mean, now, because we have more patriarchal cultures than matrilineal cultures, they're patrilocal. So the women go to their husbands' families, though there are still some that go the other way around. And the other thing is that it's more dangerous to stay at home.
Mm.
You know, the most dangerous place for an American woman is in her own household. She is most likely to be beaten or murdered by somebody she knows in her own house.
Mm.
So the statistical truth is it's safer on the road than at home.
Phew! Wow.
But I think that travel and the on-the-road state of mind is a right of all of us, women and men. It's probably in our cellular makeup from the millennia upon millennia of following the seasons, following the crops, following animals, living in camps. You know, we need both home and the road. And I think that's what I realized while I was writing this book, that both personally, because my father had no home, and my mother had no journey of her own.
Right.
That we both need both, and we all need both.
Yes.
And I have, over time, created a life in which I have both, and I suspect it is really in ourselves that we all need that. I mean, even birds have a nest, right?
Right. So true. The ending of the book and the balance and the peace which you have found in creating a life for yourself, to have both was deeply and is deeply inspirational. And I really want to thank you for writing this book. And if any of you, if you don't have this book and you haven't read this book, please read it because it is fascinating and just absolutely brilliant. I really, really enjoyed it.
You know,
I so enjoyed it. I so enjoyed it. I really did.
So we have some time for a question.
Hi. I noticed how I was one of the younger people in the audience tonight. I'm 16.
Oh, right. Yes.
And I was wondering what you thought our generation could do to continue moving forward with equality.
I think you know. You know, I mean, sometimes mothers will say to me, you know, with alarm, my daughter doesn't know who you are. And I will say, but does she know who she is? That's the point.
Right.
You know, I don't care if she knows who I am.
Yes.
We're here to support you, you know.
Yep.
So, you know, what do you care about? What do you love to do so much that you forget what time it is when you're doing it? That you would do even if you didn't get paid, though I devoutly want you to get paid. You know, each of us is this unique person that is the result of millennia upon millennia of environment and heredity combined in a way that could never happen before and could never happen again. So that your ability to express that is the whole point, and we're here to support you. And regardless of what it is that keeps you from expressing that, unjust thing is happening, that's what needs changing.
Mm. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming, and thank you especially to Gloria Steinem and
yes.
Jada Pinkett Smith. Thank you so much.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was feminist icon, journalist, and activist Gloria Steinem, whose latest memoir is My Life on the Road. She was joined in conversation by actress and entrepreneur Jada Pinkett Smith. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, Maya Finley, and Jake Gukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.